Welcome to WMBC in Exile. I'm Josh Marciante, WMBC Chief Engineer. On the show today, we're going to discuss the station's long and complex history in as much detail as we can afford in these next few minutes together. We'll speak to a former station officer to catch you up on recent station history in commemoration of our second episode. This program would not have been possible if it wasn't for the support of all of our station members, all who have been actively waiting and rooting for us. Thank you so much to everyone who's believed in us and supported us through these difficult times. We also want to give a shout out to all of the officers who kept WMBC in good standing without a broadcast to look forward to. Thank you so much for keeping the dream alive. Our station manager from 2021 to 22 was Caden Moe. And our station manager from 2019 to 2021 was Hunter Newman. Each of these management teams consisted of dozens of dedicated students, all of which we owe this broadcast to today. WMBC began its life as WUMD Student Broadcasting Association in September 1975, with roots going back much further. It originally operated out of a space in the basement of the Math and Psychology Building, which at the time was called the Engineering and Mathematics Building. Their first semester of operation, fall 1975, carried only 10 hours per week of a broadcast schedule, and the only place the station was audible was in one cafeteria on a closed-loop system. In February 1977, WUMD moved to a current carrier AM signal, which transmitted radio signals through the power lines in certain campus buildings. This was a very short-distance signal and was only receivable inside a few of the dorm buildings on campus. WUMD sought to expand throughout the 1980s, submitting large budget requests for new equipment and capabilities. UMBC opened the University Center in September 1982, which served as the commons of its day. This building at the time housed the bookstore, several organization offices, and dining locations. The building also contained several lounge spaces for student gatherings. The Retriever and the SGA had offices built in this facility, and WUMD was shortly approved to move from Math and Psychology to the University Center in May 1983. $10,000 was allocated to prepare the space for the station. This building still serves as the home of the Retriever, and it did serve as the home of WMBC until very recently, though the rest of the building has vastly changed, with most student organization offices moving to the Commons Building when it was built in the early 2000s. With a new space, WUMD wanted a new sound, stereo sound to be precise. The idea of an FM broadcast dated back to these early 80 times. WUMD began an effort to convert the station to FM over a period of approximately 8 years, starting in 1982. An SGA candidate in May 1983 ran on a platform to convert WUMD to a new FM station. WUMD purchased new equipment and hired law firms to assist with the project. However, there were several roadblocks, including a protest filed by area station WETA, that might have faced interference due to the proposed new station's frequency. Attempts continued, however, until 1990. Student paper articles from the time don't mention any dedicated staff from UMBC looking after the project, so it's possible that this project was shouldered entirely by students who would not have attended the school long enough to see the project through. If this is true, it's probably no surprise that the funding source for this FM conversion project, the SGA's Student Projects Fund, changed priority in the fall of 1990. A new daycare center was to be built on campus, which diverted funds away from that FM project. Ultimately, WUMD failed to secure an FM license, and over the 8-year period, the project had spent approximately $45,000. WUMD was subsequently dropped from the SGA's budget, which led to a brief suspension of station operations in 1990. In January 1991, WUMD was reported to be running on an emergency budget of only $700. This started a series of years of modest operation for WUMD. They continued to host and support events on campus, but the station no longer carried the same energy after the lengthy failure of the FM transition. AM continued to lose popularity in listeners, and the reception was very limited, only being receivable in a handful of dorm buildings, the university center, and via a cable channel in the campus apartments. By 1994, WUMD's current carrier transmitters had fallen out of calibration, which was a procedure that had to be performed by a professional that the station did not have the funds to hire. The station was in a dark age, but despite this, continued to host several events on campus and work towards a better future. The station spearheaded several concerts from 1995 to 1996, but despite this, was still struggling to simply operate. The signal was extremely weak on campus, but change was just around the corner, with several projects in quiet development outside the public eye. Starting in September 1998, a new sound swept UMBC. WUMD officially changed its call sign to WMBC, the call sign that it operates under today, and restarted broadcasting with a new antenna located on the Biological Sciences Building. Up to this point, the broadcasting had been restricted to current carrier broadcasts under the FCC Part 15 rules. However, a loophole in the FCC's rules was discovered, which allowed college radio stations to broadcast over the air within 100 feet of the campus property without having to receive a special license. With this new antenna, WMBC could theoretically be received over a much broader area on campus. It turned out that this new format ended up trading one evil for another. While the broadcast could now be received over the air, which was a large step up from the current carrier system, the coverage bubble was very small, at sometimes estimated to be only 50 feet from the antenna, and that bubble now sat far outside the residential side of campus, which was the previously established area that WMBC could be received in. It was also still AM, the far less contentious band of frequencies, because very few stations still made use of it. Sound quality was far worse on AM as well. To try and mitigate some of these difficulties, the new antenna coupled with a brand new format, web broadcasting was used for the first time. The station began to operate 24 hours a day, with a new 100-disc CD changer serving as the overnight DJ, should staffing prove to be unavailable. The WMBC recording studio also began offering services to the campus community during this time, offering mixing, mastering, and CD production for local bands. The 21st century brought hope of another shot at FM broadcasts, as the FCC changed its rules, allowing a new type of station to be licensed, Low Power FM, or LPFM. This type of station license seemed designed for a station like WMBC. The license was intended for small, local stations that offered content not typically found in mainstream radio. Representatives of the Prometheus Radio Project visited the campus in the early 2000s to promote the new license type, which gave new attention to the campus station. However, the early 2000s was fraught with scares for the new station. A new congressional bill had been introduced that would have severely restricted the FCC's ability to issue these licenses. The RIAA, Recording Industry Association of America, proposed charging huge royalties for web content broadcasting, and there were many other things that came up due to this new internet age. WMBC was still operating on shoestring budget at this time, so no major improvements were able to be made. The new domains of the internet were yet to be realized at this time, and the music industry made a number of well-documented blunders in attempting to bring the internet in line with previous forms of media, such as the Sony Rootkit scandal. With hindsight, we know the record labels would ultimately give up on their attempts to legislate internet media content out of existence, and in fact, would ultimately come to embrace it with streaming services. but the members and the board of WNBC couldn't have known this at the time. Because of this uncertainty and their very minimal budget, despite the new format and equipment, listenership still struggled. WNBC made attempts to have their station feed broadcast across campus, including in the newly constructed commons and outside some academic buildings. They also held many events designed to reach out to the student body across 2002 to 2003, including weekly concerts near the commons in the fall of 2003. These concerts, held in partnership with the Student Events Board, were widely praised by the campus community. This brought newfound interest to the station. The spring 2004 semester started with WNBC reportedly almost fully staffed and with 85 DJs ready to spin their tunes, a big change from previous years. Still operating on very little financial support from UMBC, the station began making a new name for itself, holding several concerts a semester on the UMBC campus. The Commons Quad and Flat Tuesdays, known then as the Cabaret, seemed like they were WMBC's unofficial second homes. The spring 2005 SGA elections involved WMBC quite a bit. A few candidates made WMBC some portions of their platform, including wishing to move WMBC's offices to the Commons with the SGA, and generally wanting the SGA to be more active with WMBC. The SGA subsequently ran radio ads with WMBC, but it's unclear if the partnership went any further with this. Fall 2005 brought a desperately needed SGA grant to WMBC. The legislating and lobbying on behalf of the student body had yielded some results. The equipment had aged significantly, and without consistent financial support, aside from events which were not allowed to be used for purchasing equipment, there was a desperate need to upgrade this equipment. The $15,500 grant was almost immediately eaten up by equipment replacement and upgrades. The internet presence, meanwhile, began to emerge as the dominant platform during this time, with students able to have friends, classmates, and family tune in and interact from anywhere. Sometime between 2005 to 2013, the station went online only. We aren't sure when this occurred exactly, as our main source of information for this segment of the episode, which is the Retriever Student Newspapers Archives, drops off significantly around 2007. What we do know is that this grant was not game-changing, and WMBC continued to struggle for its existence financially. The SGA would only fund events on campus. Booms and busts of interest were common, with the early 2010s being a definite bust. In 2014, a new cohort of officers began their tenures and began the station anew. A shiny new website and broadcasting system brought members' curiosity up, and many new shows were scheduled. Unfortunately, this boom was cut short by a poor leadership transition, technical issues, and the COVID-19 pandemic. We won't cover as much about this phase of our history, as this isn't well documented by third-party sources. However, we will speak with a few former officers who were present during this time who can more accurately describe the circumstances and events of recent history. Astute observers may have noticed the theme across these 40-ish years of station history. WMBC has, for decades, experienced booms and busts of interest. This has been a stated concern from campus administration about the station. While there's not much that we think can be done about the fundamental four-year cycle of student presence at a given university, a constant throughout remained WMBC's financial difficulties and a general lack of support from the administration. Since 1990, funding was scarce, if existent at all. Officers have not been able to be compensated for their involvement, unlike organizations such as the Retriever or the Student Government Association. UMBC's SGA funding policies prioritize events, which WMBC found great success in during the second half of its history. But the station still struggled with old equipment and the inability to retain personnel for more than 4 years. Its studio also attracted some criticism from station personnel at the time. They believed WMBC should have moved to the Commons with most of the other student organizations when that building first opened. In November 2005, the assistant station manager at the time, Stuart McSpadden, put it as, quote, "It is a total catch-22. Without a better location, and without some support from the school, we can't become more widely known and successful. And we won't get support at a new location until we become successful, unquote. WMBC is also not a chartered organization. This means that WMBC is not able to submit a budget directly to the SGA, but instead must go through the established SGA Finance Board policies. The Finance Board was established for funding events on campus and is not intended for funding equipment, space, staff, or other things that are necessary to run a well-functioning radio station. With all that said, let's get to a conversation we had with one of the former station officers. Kobe Samuel served as the chief engineer from 2017 to 2020, and we recently sat down for a conversation with him about the recent station history and where the station is going.
My name's Kobe. I was a member of the station, and then for a while the chief engineer from about 2017 to, I want to say it was 2020. I'm pretty sure I want to say the pandemic was really what kind of nailed the coffin shut. Might have been 2021. Hell, it could have been earlier, actually. But I know it was pandemic, at least. I joined back in 2017 due to Involvement Fest, when it was still like that little patch of land for the quad. And I was just really enamored by it. Like, John Lewis was the library manager. He was kind of like the main advertising guy at the time. I haven't kept in touch with him. He's a really cool dude, though. I'm sure I'll see him again at some point. And I was just sold. I was just great. You know, and I went to the first general body meeting, you know, went to a good number of them, got a show, and just dug into it. You know, I mean, when I went to the training, like when Noah was there and she was like kind of leading the charge on that, it was just a lot of fun because we still had that space. I didn't really know any of the issues with the administration at the time. And it was just amazing because I'd never really done radio before. I was just like, holy crap, I can just like press a button and go live and talk to people, you know, like talk one way to people, play music and all that, you know, because I was already a fan of radio shows. And I was just like, I could do something like that. So I did. And then, you know, within a year, I guess because they were desperate, they were like, oh, let's make him chief engineer because he's really dedicated.
I just wanted to ask, like, what kind of good stuff happened?
While
you were in the station, you know, you were part of this part of when the station was operating at close to what I would say like peak potential.
Yes.
What was some of the highlights of your time at the station?
So, making the show in and of itself, meeting new DJs, like there was a couple people, like there was what was his name, Michael Adams? Dr. Adams was a Hilltop Institute professor, and I loved being on his show or like listening to his show, helping him out with stuff. Cause you know, he wasn't always getting the technology, and that's okay. Cause it was very custom finicky technology at sometimes, you know? And you know, I was just sitting there listening to music, and we'd be talking while the music was playing. Cause obviously the mics are muted, you know, and I learned how to do that. I was learning how to be really adept at like controlling the soundboard and like making sure everything was just right.
Yeah.
And so we'd listen to new music, so much fun just like learning new stuff. He turned me on to a few songs. Like, I didn't really know Laurie Anderson before then, but he kind of turned me on to Laurie Anderson, and I was like, oh man, this is actually really cool, you know. And then like Al Soto, he's another guy, he's an alum of UMBC. He's been an alum since before I came, and he would always have a show. He'd always pull in like these amazing guests. I had no idea how he did, but he was just like the most charming guy when it came to those guests. And just like I knew they had a great time. And it was just kind of fun experiencing that, just meeting other DJs and doing that type of stuff. And then there were the concerts, you know, before RMS came around, WMBC was the one that really did it.
Yeah.
And so we'd have local bands, UMBC bands, kind of just performing. And it was so good, man. It was like just those concerts, just like feeling the exhilaration, helping out with like streaming it on the radio. That was so much fun. And then the last thing was probably just like we did a little foray into streaming the like announcing Retriever basketball events. This is way before the 16-1 seed thing that happened at UVA. So this is like not in their prime, but it was really fun just to have like, and this other guy, Michael, really great guy too. He was kind of like the voice of reason. He was the assistant station manager, and he was the voice of reason to Nova, because Nova would sometimes make very silly decisions. And he'd be like, hold on, let's pull it back for a second. Let's, think about it, you know, and I respected that immensely. He was a great dude. I hope he's doing all right. But he would be the one doing like those things because he had a good deep baritone voice, you know, like that really smooth voice, that smooth jazzy voice, you know, and it was just like,
oh yeah.
Yeah. See, I mean, that was like, it was a lot of, the good stuff for me was, yeah, basically just being able to help with, you know, setting up live stuff and meeting other DJs and all that, you know.
What was the station like when you left?
Well, Sonica stopped working and Nova refused to work on it. So it was kind of just dead in the water. You know, no one could do anything. We were like, you can still record it on your own equipment, but no one had their own equipment. We didn't, you know, we knew about the digital media library. We talked about it. We said, go here and record your shows and send us the episode and we'll upload it and make sure people see it. But they didn't want that. They wanted live. They wanted the phone. They wanted, I mean, like a lot of people use the phone. Al Soto used the phone. I used the phone.
But the live aspect of the station was very important.
That was like the key thing.
The key thing.
If we couldn't do that, it would basically make the radio, it's not a radio station anymore. It just becomes a podcast center. It becomes like fucking NPR podcast and blab or whatever the hell they call it. You know, no one wants that. They want live. They want, because you can't publish music to podcasts either. That was another thing. We learned a lot of the legal ins and outs. So if your show is mostly music, your podcast wouldn't go anywhere. Otherwise, it would just be marked down as like a DMCA copyright thing. And that was normal. That was fine. They were just like, okay, as long as I can listen to it and get the MP3s later just to like have for my own record. And sure, we did. We recorded every single show. But if the live wasn't there, what's the point? You know? If I did a show again, I'd want it to be live because I'd have a phone call thing and I'd say, call in, talk to me. You know?
Right. And so, yeah, let's... Now I want to talk a little bit about what we've been dealing with. So we've had several meetings with administration up to and including Nancy Young.
We talked with Ashby.
Oh, really? You did get... Oh, yeah, you mentioned that.
Yeah. So we've had several meetings with campus leadership, and the end result of all of that has been, obviously, as you know,
yes.
We've been kicked out of the space officially. That's now storage space. And they've said, you can do what your station does in the digital media lab in the library and in collaboration with the music department. So
not true, but okay.
What's your reaction to that?
I doubt that either place has a working tape deck, working vinyl cassette, or vinyl record player, and a telephone, all and an advanced soundboard with soundproofing, all in the same space. You know, I'm sure that the music department, this place has like the soundproofing, a little bit of soundproofing. The music department certainly has soundproofing in spades, like expensive soundproofing, because it's the music department. They have the money. But they don't have the essentials to make a radio station room. You know, it's, and it has no soul either. That's kind of like the key part too. It's just a music room. And then as soon as your thing's up, you're going to have like little undergrads knocking on the door saying, excuse me, we have a reservation and blah, blah, blah. Can you please get out? Because people would go over frequently. I mean, we had that at the radio station too, but it wasn't as big a deal. But with those students, they'd get upset. They'd go complain to the music department. The music department would kick us out. Same here. I mean, I'm sure if we went over by 5 minutes, that guy in the other room would be like, you guys need to leave because I need to leave.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So with a radio station, you could go in at any time, you know, as long as the doors was, and if the doors weren't unlocked, you'd call the police and just say, unlock the door. You know, not the actual station door, but the outer door, because the outer door, it's a funny thing. You know, so it was always technically available as long as you had swipe access to the main thing, you know?
Yeah. And this is what we've been telling the leadership people. We actually contacted all these groups separately, and we were like, hey, you know, we've been told that we need to contact you about doing what we need to do with the station. And the response was pretty much, it was a variety of things, but mostly it boiled down to either they hadn't been told what we needed, or they had been told wrong things about what we needed.
I'm sure it's more the latter, and they probably just did things without asking.
Neither the DML here or the music department were consulted, nor could they accommodate us for our needs.
Of course not.
To record. The recording studio in the Performance Arts Humanities building, we've been in touch with Alan Warnenberger, who runs that studio.
Oh, and sure. He has a lot of conditions and all that, right?
He said that we could get a few hours per semester to record there.
Yeah.
which is definitely not ideal.
Not even close. Because some people's shows would be running for 3 hours, you know? So it's like you get one show a semester. What the hell is that?
And you can't even record like one podcast.
No.
You're doing one, like if you're doing an hour a week,
yeah,
which is a fairly standard for like a professional podcast,
mm-hmm.
you know, you'd run out of time. And that would be one podcast. You couldn't even fit any others. And you know, we have a whole student body, you know, that we're trying to
and give again, you the platform. That would be for podcasting and not
live.
Exactly.
That's probably yeah. We don't have like the system either. They're gonna do radio.co or something like that since Nova kinda up and took the system, destroyed it. You know, we were going to radio.co or one of those other things. We were so close to having that too. Like they were like so eager and then everything shut down and they're like, yeah, fuck you. Let's get rid of that. And that's going to be the easiest headache to get rid of because of the pandemic. You know, they can just chalk it up to whatever reason. That's the easiest reason they could think of. They've been looking to get rid of the station forever because it's just too much of a headache for them.
Why do you think it's a headache for them?
Because, like I said, there's that lull thing where it goes down in quality, up in quality, because it might shut down for a little bit because management's just shit. Because the previous management put too much faith in one person to do the right thing, and that person didn't want to do it at the end of the day, even though they thought they did. And they didn't do anything to actually do anything about it. They just kind of let things fall off and burn. And then the administration has to step in, or like Lovilio has to step in and be like, stop, we're done. You know, until someone else new comes along. Or it's because, like, it's too much paperwork, or it's too much, like, they want this space, or they don't like this student, or they don't like what we're talking about. Because if we have a new show, we could, like, make a new show about, like, all the things that UMBC does wrong. And they're like, oh, you shouldn't be talking bad about the university on university property. You know, it's like, you know, what's free speech then? You know, it's a whole thing, a gamut of things that make them want to just kill this off because they don't care for it. You know, Retriever's lucky that they're still alive. I'm sure if the Retriever wasn't so complacent when it comes to their articles, they'd probably been axed too. You know, they don't want negative press. That's all they're trying to do. They're trying to squash dissent or the idea of bad press. You know, and WNBC can easily be bad press if one person says a wrong thing. At least with Retriever, they can look at the print words beforehand and go, that looks good, we like that, send it.
Right.
You know, there's no free journalism on campus anymore. So unless you make your own, pay to get it printed or print it out on your own thing and then distribute it yourself. And even then, the police might step in and say you can't distribute literature.
Right.
So that's all it is. It's because they don't want the freedom of expression, freedom of speech on here. They just want what they want is good news and higher enrollment and higher good articles in actually published newspapers, you know?
Yeah. So what do you think, you know, if you listed all these problems, what would you do to fix those? How would you, like,
well,
in an ideal world, let's say you can poke and prod and twist every knob, like what would you do to make the station whole and keep it going for the long term?
Well, I'd have to make sure that there's a good management transition plan in place. If that means paying management so they don't fuck things up, I'd do it. The free speech thing, you can't help. People need to say what they want to say. Obviously, you can't tolerate the intolerant, but, you know, no one's done anything, at least on our radio station that I've been involved in, anything that's been that type of monstrous where they say something completely off the walls that we have to kind of renege on. You know, they need to accept the fact that people can say things. People are smart enough to be able to say the right things. And if they aren't, then we can discipline them ourselves and say, don't say that. You know, like, as long as it's not something that is inherently allowed to say. On top of that, you need a dedicated space, dedicated server, dedicated this and that, that requires full-time staff or someone else who can, like, dedicate their life or at least their job to making sure that things run correctly. If that's an online service and we pay yearly for it, then so be it. Just manage it well. Make the university want WNBC to be something they want again. You know, it's not impossible. Maybe with this new Ashby administration, once all the new people come in, you might have a chance. But, you know, until then, she's listening to them, or they're just doing what they want anyway, and we're stuck in the same boat because they're like, oh, we don't like this, or we don't like that. Or they don't say that. They're like, oh, they don't have enough this and that, but it's because they don't like what we say. You know? So, yeah.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Kobe.
Thank you.
Former chief engineer of WNBC. Very grateful to have you on the program. Thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you.
Special thanks to the Albin O. Kuhn Library and Gallery at UMBC for their digital archives, without which research for this episode would have been almost impossible. Also special thanks to Dr. Jason Laviglio, our faculty advisor, for providing additional information in researching this episode. Our sources for this episode include The Retriever, the UMBC student newspaper, and oral history and testimony from former station members. This is an evolving story. If you are previously involved with the station and wish to provide input, please email us at wmbc@umbc.edu. Also, please check out our other episodes. All of them are available on our website, wmbc.umbc.edu. This episode was written by Josh Marciante and Joao Veloso, and it was produced by Josh Marciante. Farewell for now, but remember, don't let student voice die.